Are we ready to start?
We're good here.
We're going to discuss leases and we're going to go to the team.
Good afternoon and good morning. Today we are back speaking to you about leases for the first time in a long time. And we have two papers to discuss with you today. First of all, there's paper 3A, memo 359, that provides a high-level summary of the feedback we've received on the 2013 ED. Now, you may question my use of the word high-level, given that the paper is 76 pages long. But, by the way, given the breadth of views and the amount of feedback received, I can confirm that it really is a relatively high-level summary of that feedback. The second paper is paper 3B, memo 260, that sets out our thinking on the sequencing and grouping of topics for re-deliberation. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with paper 3A, memo 259, the summary of feedback. And what we'd like to do is to discuss the paper and the feedback in sections. So as staff, we tee up each sort of major section of the summary and then open it up and hand over to you for questions and comments before then moving on to the next sort of major section of the paper. And what we think is perhaps we spend something like an hour to an hour and 15 minutes actually discussing the feedback, so that then we leave at least 30 minutes or slightly more to discuss actually the re-deliberation plan. So with that, maybe if we turn to paper 3A, memo 259. So first of all, just to explain the feedback and where the feedback has come from. The paper summarises feedback received both in comment letters as well as at outreach meetings discussed during and after the comment period. So to date we've received 638 comment letters from around the world. A large proportion of those letters are from preparers or preparer industry organisations. But we also received actually a surprising number from investors and analysts, in that there are more than 20 comment letters from investors and analysts or investor and analyst associations. And of course, we also received comment letters from regulators, from academics, from the accounting firms, and from accounting associations, etc. In addition to that, we received feedback during the comment period and right up until the middle of October in outreach meetings. And we really tried to focus our outreach efforts on meetings that would really kind of supplement the feedback we get in comment letters. So we kind of had three main categories of outreach meetings. The first were meetings with investors and analysts. If you combine the meetings we had discussing both lessees and lessor accounting, we had more than 50 meetings with around 280 investors and analysts from around the world. Now, most of these, I see, were discussing the lessee accounting proposals, but we also did get access to some investors and analysts that, you know, specifically follow lessors. And the purpose there, of course, is really to help us better understand and assess the benefits of the proposal. Secondly, we organised what we've referred to as fieldwork meetings. Those were individual meetings held with preparers. Almost all were at the preparers' premises. Very deliberately so that we could get access to not only the accounting personnel, but also people who work in IT departments, investor relations departments, operations departments, legal departments, really to try and get hopefully a better understanding of the costs and implications of implementing the proposals, and really trying to understand better what aspects of the proposals might really drive the cost. And finally, we held public roundtables in September and October in various locations. And the purpose there was, of course, just to try and get a better understanding of what some constituents would write in their comment letters by actually having a direct, you know, conversation and debate with them at those roundtable forums. So that's the background. So now I'm going to actually get into the feedback. And you'll see in the paper, if we maybe start with letting accounting. And in the paper, letting accounting feedback is covered in paragraphs 14 through to 50 of the paper. Now, when I tee up the letting accounting feedback, I'm also going to tee up what's included under the classification section. So that's in paragraphs 81 to 89 of the paper. Just because I think those two sections are so interlinked, you know, talking about classification as well as the letting accounting proposal. So first of all, in the feedback, we split it into sort of views on the balance sheet and views on the income statement, cash flow statement proposal. First of all, regarding the balance sheet, many constituents do support and agree with our proposals that a lessee would recognise assets and liabilities for leases of more than 12 months. They agree that they think there is something broken in existing lessee accounting. Leases create assets and liabilities, and it would be misleading not to recognise those assets and liabilities on the balance sheet. Of those constituents, that includes a majority of the investors and analysts we spoke to. There was particularly strong support from credit analysts, who of course are more focused on assessing leverage and looking at a liabilities side of a company's financial statements. The views of equity analysts are more mixed, but nonetheless, a majority of those equity analysts have told us that they think the balance sheet proposals would provide them with a better starting point which to base their analysis. And there's also support for the balance sheet proposals from regulators, from many of the standard setters, from many of the accounting firms, and also from some preparers. But of course, not everybody agrees, and many disagree with the proposal. Not all users support the changes proposed. Many of those users actually who disagree actually say they agree that leases create assets and liabilities. However, they'd actually prefer the amounts to be bigger. They'd want bigger assets and liabilities. Some are concerned about the effects of such a significant change on their models and on their trend analysis. And some also say that any one amount they think could never provide a complete picture of the economics of leases. And therefore, they would suggest improving disclosure rather than changing recognition and measurement. There's a lot of concern in comment letters and at outreach meetings about costs and complexity, of course, particularly from preparers, but also from some of the accounting firms and other constituent groups. Some of the preparers are also concerned about the wider effects or consequences of such a significant change in accounting. So, for example, the effects it might have on debt covenants or regulatory requirements. That will be touched on later, by the way, in the paper, so the kind of other effects we'll talk about later. And also a lot of concern just about the scope of the proposals. And it is in particular about the cost associated with applying the proposals to the very large volume of what is often considered to be small ticket or small dollar value leases. That's the balance sheet. As I move on to the income statement, investors and analysts' views on the income statement does largely fall into two camps. We have the industry-specific analysts that generally support the dual model proposed. So almost all of the airline and transport analysts we spoke to really support receiving an income statement that separates interest from amortization, whilst almost all of the retail, restaurants and hotel analysts support receiving, looking at an income statement with a single lease expense included for those types of lessees. The dual model proposed also is supported by some users who really think that the income statement should sort of reflect or separate out what a lessee is paying for consumption or depreciation of the underlying assets separately from what they're paying for financing. Many other users, however, including most of the credit analysts, would prefer a sort of a single type A model. They really view leases as creating assets and debt-like liabilities, and therefore they think that if leases are recognised on balance sheet, then interest should be presented separately in the income statement. And there also are some users, by the way, who support the balance sheet change and would actually prefer a single lease expense recognised on a straight line basis, actually for all leases that are currently classified as operating leases. In terms of other constituents, actually very mixed views on the income statement. Some would suggest reverting back to a single type A model for both conceptual and cost reasons. And they sort of say that they think any attempt to differentiate between different leases under a right of use model really doesn't make sense to them. There's many that actually say the opposite. They say we support, we think there really does need to be a dual model, but they prefer retaining the existing distinction between operating or finance capital leases because it's understood and because it works well in practice. And I think those constituents are concerned both about the complexity of having any kind of new classification of leases, but also some of them think that today's distinction really does capture better the differing economics of leases. You have others who understand and support the dual model proposed and the consumption thinking, but they would certainly suggest simplifications to that model. So many were concerned about how do you interpret insignificant, major part, substantially all. And some others disagree with some of the outcomes that would have happened under our proposal. For example, some said there were some very long-term land leases that could end up being classified as type A. Some others were concerned, for example, they thought our definition of property was too narrow. And there were certain things like telecommunications towers that they felt should really be considered and treated as property. Some others are concerned about the tension that arises between the balance sheet and income statement under type B accounting. Now, some of those actually agree with the consumption thinking and the principle, but when they look at what they consider to be that tension or difference between balance sheet and income statement, they would suggest actually that they agree with consumption, but they'd say then, any asset where we think there really is a significant consumption, I don't think it should be recognised on the balance sheet. And you have some others who would suggest actually they think preparers should have an option to apply only type A accounting or only type B accounting to all of their leases. And I suppose finally there are various others who suggest, I suppose, different and various ways that you could get to a straight line answer under the proposals, but that is sort of different from our sort of type B accounting that was proposed. So I suppose with that, I'd say that is my high level summary and tee up around lessee accounting. And I'd hand over to board members for any questions or comments.
Maru? I'd like to make a general comment on this. First of all, I think it's important to congratulate staff and acknowledge the huge effort for feedback that we try to get, not only with more than 600 letters, this demonstrates the interest of the project, but also with the outreach activities that we perform all over the world. I participate in a number of activities, and of course, I cannot gather everything, so that's why the summary and the deliberation that will come will be key for us to go ahead with the project. I still believe, although in the sessions I participate, I really captured my sense was a mixed view with regards to the whole project. But my sense is that there is a general support for right of use versus liability and the liability model. So, and you mentioned only the first part of the feedback on the lessee model. And the many views around the lessee model, alternative views and aspects that were brought to our attention. So I just think we made a very comprehensive outreach. We have a huge source of material gathering in the comment letters. and it's not trivial to explore. For every single point, I think there are interconnected relationship with even other projects. You mentioned the telecom towers that was recently discussed in the E3 under the concept of property and equipment. And so it's not trivial. I think we need to be aware that we need time to understand all the aspects provided in the feedback, the interrelations within the model itself. And we need time to think through and perform a thorough analysis of the material that we have that is quite rich. I still believe it's possible to finalize the project using the rationale that we developed, but we need time to understand what is in the material that we receive.
Jan?
Well, I've lived very close to this project for the last year. And if we recall, we had a little bit of a time out. We discussed this with one or two models, and we made the exposure draft. And the last 6 or 7 or 8 months, something, I've spent more time on this than perhaps I should. Participate in a lot of the outreach meetings and met a lot of former colleagues preparing. And you do an excellent summary. And the problem with the summary, when you have many thousands of inputs, is that you get sort of a little bit of an average conclusion. First of all, I think it's important to say that this is an extremely important project. I think it's important for a lot of people from a pure economical point of view, but also for standard setting and trust of financial information and things like that. But I think we must really realize that this is something we must take extremely seriously, whatever we go with. So we have met analysts, and we made a couple of examples. And one example was one airline compared to another airline. They were very similar in structure and in whatever you compared. One of them had 2/3 on leasing, and the other had 1/3 on leasing. And you got, of course, totally different operating performance, because the one with a lot of leasing got interest expense into the operating performance. Also, we presented to users how do they make adjustments for liabilities. And we had them made a little bit of comparison what was the actual liability. So when we presented this to users, some of them blushed, some of them were good poker players who didn't blush, but they should have blushed. And I'd say most of them, when we presented a couple of cases like that, they absolutely admitted that a change is needed, information is not good enough. So then we met with a number of preparers, and I recall very much when we met with one preparer in Europe, an excellent meeting, spent most of the day, met a lot of different people, and in the end, I posed the question, so how much will the changeover for you be? And also a guy without blushing said, it will be 100 million euros. But without any foundation, as I understood it. We took a flight to another capital in Europe the day after, met with another company, not similar, but still, one made an excellent, really excellent analysis. How much training, how much IT, how much this and how much that. They had a number which was totally different from the other one. We went with one company who were in a business, and they said, this is horrible, it's extremely expensive, extremely complicated. We met with a worse competitor, same market, same structure, and they said, we don't see a problem at all. What we have got here is so much diverging opinions about cost and complexity and consequences. But I think it is almost impossible to understand really where we are. And when we move forward on the lessee side, I think it's extremely important that we try to take out these sort of, give them a high number of the cost so they get scared and drop the whole thing. That type of thing you must clear out. We also have, in my mind, and I'm quite convinced we will come back to that, simplification to do. A lot of the complexity people talk about is because you have two models, so we have to train 200 subsidiaries around the world to define this or that.
Reassessment.
I think we can perhaps come back to reassessment. Perhaps we have a solution to that.
Small ticket items.
I'm convinced we have a solution to that. I think when we take a tick off these things, I think we can see alternatives come out of this. And we have to analyze it, we have to get confirmation from people that, yes, this is the way we can work, this will take away complexity, take away cost, take away IT expenses, and thereby see that we have realistic alternatives that we can convince people of. The user value compensates more than needed for to do these changes. So I really think that I'm very confused. I'm less confused in a sense than before, because I'm thought to understand this a little bit. But I'm confused because the information we get about the cost and complexity from preparing is, to some extent, fake numbers. And many of them don't have numbers, they have just opinions. And we must go behind that before we come in to take the decision. Otherwise, people will shoot it down for the reason that we don't have the right backing. So I think we have a lot of work to do before we can come to final conclusions on this.
Patricia.
I also want to congratulate the staff on doing an excellent outreach effort. They made tremendous efforts to not only get views from participants, but also understand what was driving those opinions and get the facts behind what they were. I also believe that the outreach shows that we have support to move forward with the project. And I think we got a lot of excellent suggestions about ways we can improve and at the same time simplify the project moving forward. But I think it's going to take us some time to sort through all those suggestions and select the best ones that are most cost-benefit oriented and to tweak some of the individual aspects of the project. But I'm really looking forward to moving forward and the coming months debating all the issues that we can improve on.
Thank you. I wish, you know, this project is finished as quickly as possible with Fazi, and because they are all the people here, they are putting all kinds of time and effort to finish this important project, so I totally agree with their direction providing. But I just want to ask just a very technical one, as quite a clarification. Paragraph 26, you said there are some equity analysts and some credit rating, maybe credit analysts too, they are asking for the whole asset approach and ongoing perpetual commitment. They are suggesting us to make a note disclosure about this or recognize these items maybe on the balance sheet?
I think in paragraph 26 what we're referring to is that what some of the equity analysts explained to us, you know, when we talked to them, because by the way, in all of those meetings we asked, you know, are you making adjustments today? If you are, how are you adjusting and what's your purpose? What are you trying to achieve? And particularly for the equity analysts, I think often their primary focus is to assess the operating performance of a company. Now, clearly they tell us they can't assess operating performance without, or they can't assess the company properly without also looking at leverage and taking into account leverage, but first and foremost, it's often operating performance. So they're often looking at metrics like trying to work out, you know, the performance, the return that companies are generating off the sort of capital employed or invested capital. So sometimes what some of those equity analysts are trying to do, particularly those, for example, say the airline analysts who follow sectors where you get, you know, quite big differences between companies that own, you know, assets versus those that lease assets. They are actually making some of their adjustments to try and get at a sort of comparative asset base. So they're trying to, you know, effectively uplift the assets as if the companies had bought those assets. And that's what sort of is referred to as a whole asset model. Some of those, therefore, would say, and sorry, the other view there you asked about the ongoing perpetual commitments, that's a slightly different view that often, that was sometimes, for instance, some of the retail analysts and others said that, where they said, I'm focused more on the commitments liability side, but I don't necessarily just want to know the contractual commitments. You know, I'm not concerned about whether there's just 2 years to run on leases. I would rather, you know or see how much is the commitment that I think this entity needs in order to continue operating, you know, sort of indefinitely on a similar basis to today. So, you know, if I'm a retailer, I currently have 5,000 stores, what do I think is kind of a perpetual commitment base to lease 5,000 stores? Some of those, therefore, that said that would say, because I'd rather have the bigger assets and liabilities, I don't support your proposal. However, more of them said, whilst I might prefer to have bigger numbers, number one, either I know you couldn't ask for that because it would require you to make lessees recognise assets and liabilities that are not assets and liabilities. Or otherwise, they still said, though, whilst I might, you know, like to gather that information, I still think that what you will provide under your proposal, which is based on contractual commitments, still will provide me with a much better starting point on which to assess my analysis. And then some of them might have said, then I would like to make sure that in the disclosures you provide me, I still have enough information that helps me so you know, for some of my analysis, potentially, say, calculate a whole asset number.
Stephen?
I would endorse especially what Pat and Jan said about the work of the staff and the outreach. I think it's been great. And we've got an awful lot of information to absorb and learn from in going through the deliberation. I wanted to ask, though, about the user feedback, and in particular, the level of support for moving to all Type B. And I didn't find much in the comment letters. I haven't looked at all the user comment letters yet, but I couldn't find much there. And I know the feedback in the outreach, whilst those users that were exclusively focused upon retail, hotels, etc., did support Type B. Those that had a wider remit or were following other sectors, I didn't detect a great deal of support for it. And a link to that, why wasn't there the support for Type B? Was it, and some of the meetings I was in, it was this whole confusion about you have a financial liability with no interest and you've got a fixed asset with no depreciation, and it all seems extremely odd. And they get confused as to, well, what do I do in calculating return on capital? That came out in some of the meetings I was at, and was that a common theme in their sort of difficulties with Type B?
Let me start, by the way, because any of this, by the way, I'll start based on obviously, you know, the meetings I attended. I did attend a lot of the analyst and investor meetings, and by the way, I'll ask my FASB colleagues to obviously add to anything I say from their perspective. I think to see what you said. So first of all, I suppose to ask in your view, I think it's fair to say that at some of the meetings with investors and analysts, the feedback and the discussion was very much, we always started with the balance sheet essentially. In the materials we prepared, we asked them very much about the balance sheet that incorporated the measurements, you know, it was a proposed measurement. Then we asked them about the income statement, cash flow statement proposals, and we also asked them about disclosure. In some of the meetings, the discussion was more on the balance sheet. We didn't necessarily hear direct or very clear views on the income statement. In many of the meetings, though, we did get to talk about the income statement. I think, like you say, a lot of the views maybe around the income statement, it links to very much how you view leases and what you know, view them as doing, in a sense. And I suppose that a lot, from the meetings I attended, a lot of the investors and analysts we spoke to are viewing them as, I suppose, creating, as I say, debt-like liabilities. and creating assets that are kind of, you know, part of the operating assets of an entity. And if you have that view, and again, if you think about, you know, a lot of the credit analysts said, if you have that view, then I think if you say someone was saying, well, it doesn't make sense to me then on that logic not to have interests presented in the income statement. And by the way, it wasn't even, I mean, some of the retail and restaurant hotel analysts actually also said, I view leases as creating, you know, assets used in operations and debt-like liabilities. However, some of them went on to explain that they're still comfortable with a, you know, a straight line, a single expense, because either some of their ratio analysis or their metrics, they actually use EBITDA today, and they will continue to do that. But I think a lot of it's linked to debt. Like, there are others, though, who, by the way, who would view, again, leases as creating, you know, as I say, debt-like liabilities, who still are also, as I kind of say, decide, supported the dual model, still would support a kind of single straight-line number for real estate leases, because they actually are more, some of them are more sort of whole asset supporters on the balance sheet, and they were the ones that kind of said, I really think it would be beneficial for me to see a kind of a split between what is being paid as a kind of depreciation of the underlying assets versus what is being paid for financing. The only thing those investors and analysts might say is they wouldn't categorize that single lease expense as operating. They would actually consider it to be financing, because in that case they might say, I think I'm just kind of paying the less, or a return is more like interest. There were some, I think there were a number of investors and analysts, and you see it in a couple of comment letters, who actually say in their view they don't agree, they don't see a distinction between, you know, property and other than property. In their view, all leases should be treated in the same way. You know, and for example, in some of the letters they say, I think that what happens in the income statement today, the fact that there's a single straight line expense, you know, for all that is current operating leases, you know, makes sense to them. I suppose I'd say that there was quite a few who said, though they didn't want any change to the income statement, often were also saying potentially, I don't necessarily want any change to the balance sheet as well. I kind of more want improved disclosure. But there certainly were at least a few calls that I attended that there were some either saying, no, I do support the balance sheet, but I'm happy to have the income statement stay like it is today. You know, straight line. You know, sort of expense for all, but at least from what I attended, it was just a few calls.
Over to you, Russ.
Okay, thanks, Hans. Any questions or comments, Hal?
Sharing everyone's compliments to the team, a tremendous job. I also agree with Petrina's comments at the beginning. This is a very high-level summary. And one of the things I kept looking for as I went through this was some tabular presentation, some tabular document to summarize the 260 users, the differences when we use user versus constituent versus. We used a lot of different terms, and then we threw things in like some, many, a lot. Lots of different terms, and I found it a little bit difficult to go through and figure out two things, both the content of what they were saying, but more importantly, the context in which they were saying it. So I'm asking the staff, as we come back and re-deliberate these individual issues, will you provide a little bit more content and context as we talk about the lessee model, the lessor model, all the issues that you've articulated in the re-deliberation? I think it would help us understand these occasionally mixed views that we heard. And I started to make a list. You would not be surprised at the things buy side versus sell side, long strategies versus long shorts. How do they think differently? Is there geographical differences that are influenced? Clearly, there are industry differences that matter here. I think the one that may not be quite as clear is the context in which the questions were asked, in which the outreach was conducted. Having sat in on a lot of these, there are a couple of different formats that we followed. One format was a one-on-one, where we sat down, explained the model, asked some questions, got feedback. There were groups. Those groups were sometimes one single asset manager. Others were mixes. Some were more educational. Some were more, let's dig into the details. And then there were some that were company and sell-side analyst that followed that particular company. I think that the questions and the context in which those questions were asked influence how people respond to those questions. Simple examples, I think you get more direct answers when you do one-on-one than you do in groups, particularly if the groups are mixed between companies. Buy-side investors do not like to talk in front of other buy-side investors. So I want to understand better as we dig into the details what these differences are, and I think it would help address, you know, the comments that were made by Amaro and Jan and others, where a lot of detail, a lot of ways to look at this. If we can more segment the results, and I'm not saying just on users, I'm saying both for users and preparers, and present it more in a tabular form and focus in on those issues as they relate to each topic being re-deliberated, I think it would go a long way to taking what I think was a very good process to making it an excellent process. So it's both an ask and an observation on the part of the summaries. I found the summaries helpful, but I had a lot more questions about the context in which they were provided.
Tom?
Now, there were oddly significant comments about the cost and complexity of the proposal that I think that we have to be careful in considering in our re-deliberations. But I think an observation of the wide variety of estimates of costs from similar sorts of entities is an indication that it's very difficult to make an estimate without going through that whole process. And I've observed over time, too, there may be a tendency for proposals you dislike to have the estimates of the cost be higher. So while I'm recognizing the cost and the complexity is very important, I'm not sure at this point in time that there's much value to go out and try to understand that better. I think it's far better to move forward in our deliberations to come up with conclusions with cost and complexity in mind and then think about or get some reactions as to whether we've been successful in limiting some of that. But I don't see any benefit at this point going out to ask any more about cost and complexity because of the difficulty of measurement and perhaps the bias to inflate the numbers when you don't like it. And maybe they're not inflated. They're just maybe better estimated and much more work at building up how difficult it would be.
Jim?
I just wanted to add my agreement to what Tom said, particularly if there are ways that we might go about addressing some of that cost and complexity such that going and getting information, you know, might not even be responsive to the direction that one might be headed in responding to that information.
I agree with that. I know the staff has somewhat behind the scenes been looking through ways to put various alternatives in front of the board to reduce the complexity and to make the improvements based on the feedback. But I think if we were to go back out today and ask people more cost information about the proposal, we'll probably get the same information. So it seems like we should start working on solutions and then throughout the re-deliberations ask if those solutions are reducing some of the cost and complexity that were raised by our stakeholders. Anything else on Lessee? Do I turn over to you or Petrina? Petrina?
Yeah, sure, so I'll move on to Lessee. Sorry, I'll try to be much briefer now. The clock is in front of me, so... moving on to Lessee. And that, by the way, is paragraphs 51 to 80 in the paper. Overall, there was much less support, I suppose, for change to lessor accounting. Although I would say at a high level, there are two kind of very different views expressed about the link between changing lessee accounting and changing lessor accounting. There are some constituents, including some lessors, some of the accounting firms, and some standard setters, that are clear and sort of saying that they think that if lessee accounting is changed, then for them it's paramount that lessor accounting must also change. However, most of the constituents would say that they think consistency or coherency, in a sense, between lessee and lessor accounting is a nice to have, in a sense, but is not necessarily paramount. And you see something like at some of the roundtable meetings, you really saw that difference of view coming across. The first thing to say is that there is pretty unanimous support for our proposals regarding property leases, which is really saying that people both on the user side and the preparer side and otherwise say retaining existing lessor accounting for property leases works. They're also, by the way, sort of linking in with the reasons the board even proposed change. There is quite a lot of support from users to have better information about a lessor's exposure to credit risk and asset risk, particularly for equipment and vehicle leases. However, quite a few of the users we spoke to either are indifferent to whether they see that in the income statement or in disclosures, or some of them would actually say, I'd rather the accounting didn't change, I just get it as disclosure. Some of the users and the lessors, particularly who the users who follow lessors of longer lived equipment, as well as the lessors themselves. So kind of lessors, at least things like rail cars, aircraft, ships, telecom towers, they really don't support the changes proposed to lessor accounting. They're very much of the view that they don't think that, you know, recognizing, particularly the income statement, they don't think the proposals that would make their leases look much more like financing transactions make sense for them in terms of their business model. And I suppose the users that we've spoken to that follow those types of lessors, they're particularly concerned about the effects on the income statement. The lessors themselves, I suppose, are equally concerned about the effects of the income statement, as well as the costs associated with applying what would be a more complicated model than, of course, existing operating lease accounting. There are, however, some users as well as some equipment and vehicle lessors that agree with that the proposals better reflect their business model and how they price leases. Within that, though, there are actually some of those lessors who say, yes, it better reflects my business model, I would have the information. They are still told if they think the costs would potentially outweigh the benefits because they would still have to implement a new sort of accounting system to deal with the changes, even though they absolutely have all the information available, for example, about estimating the residual assets, etc. And of course, finally, there was quite a lot of just general concern about the complexity of the Type A lessor accounting model, and there were quite a few suggestions came across in comment letters as to how we could reduce the complexity under that type of framework of accounting. So with that, I'll hand over to you.
I was fascinated by the number of constituents that have decided that it's not necessary to change lessor accounting, but it would be helpful to change lessee accounting, because when I joined the board in 2009, the project was a lessee-only model, and it seemed at that time that constituents were pounding the table and saying, you've got to address lessor at the same time you address lessee, and we need a symmetrical model. And the big problem with the whole lease accounting model was that lessors got sales type or finance lease accounting, and lessees had operating leases, and we've got to fix that. And now we're hearing a sort of different story. So our
The consistency is that they always want something that we do not do.
Yeah. Someone else who said, you know, when you bring back the papers, when you come back and we start re-deliberating lessor, I'd like a little more color and in-depth explanation about why there's suddenly this change in view about how necessary it is to do Westmore accounting.
Probably on the same line, and I just support what others have said earlier. This is a very, very complex principle out there. And I think Hal's comment and now Patricia's comment that I think the devil is going to be in the detail in understanding where it comes from. I also battle to understand how people can have a different opinion on leases, on lessees and lessors. But I wondered afterwards in looking at our use of many and majority, whether many of the many, or the majority of the many, were people who had leases, who were both lessees and lessors, and didn't want the situation where they had different accounting for the two different types of land entity. Whereas the majority were perhaps people who were only lessors and were comfortable to live with one model because they didn't have to live with one model. So I do think that a lot, we're going to need to understand where that comes from, because I'm very uncomfortable with that type of outcome of two different ways of treating it. As I say, particularly for those companies that have both on their balance sheet.
Where you go? Young and Amado said, you know, this feedback tells us we should be very careful next step. And if we rush out, the outcome will not be so satisfactory. Particularly, you know, if we link some of the proposals, like, you know, let's drop off, let's all, and don't care about symmetrical. I think if you compare this project with financial instruments and insurance, you can see a drastic difference. That is, when we discuss about insurance, we never discuss with the policyholder, you know. And when we discuss about financial instruments, and you know, people may view the impact from either side, but not link them together. But in this case, I'm not sure whether your premium is or not. The driven force against us is that force. You know, everywhere they spread over, you know, the disease says no chance. It's because it is ultimately impact on their business. So assume, you know, we take the views not touch at all and don't care about the symmetrical. My expectation is, and the lessor will go to the lessee, you know, now the trouble is on your side, I will fully support you, but, you know, we should have a symmetrical result. Why you not change the lessor or carrier? And similarly, as Darrell said, you know, there are some of these issues and others. So, overall, I think we should be very careful to move to the next step.
But since this is the first time I spoke, let me also compliment the staff of both organizations for an awful lot of work over a long period of time and reading 6,000 pages or thereabouts of comment letters, which and it was job well done. And I think a few thoughts on lessor accounting. I don't think you mentioned it, Petrina, but having written comment letters on the other side is one thing I think is critical in the lessor project. We need to consider what we do on lessor in contemplation of the revenue recognition standard we just put out. They both deal with revenue recognition. And many people have said it's critical that revenue recognition and lessor accounting be aligned, you know, not inconsistent and the like. And recognizing the revenue recognition EG that you would have had in your hand when the lease proposal was written in 2011, there were many, many, many big changes to that through deliberations. I think it's going to take some time to work our way through those. If you think the revenue recognition is a control model, the current lease model is largely a risk and reward, and so on, and you think some of the last things we deliberated, the role of licensing and revenues over time and stuff, I think that's all very analogous and parallel to lessor accounting. Now, not prejudging, you know, where we come out to the same place or what we need. It's going to take a while to get through it. I do acknowledge, you know, a lot of people in here said lessor models not broken, fundamentally okay, generally leave alone. I think even without addressing whether or not I agree with that or not, but let's assume it was fundamentally okay. That said, is there still a host of issues that the comment letters and outreach confirmed? I mean, the role, the amount, size of what you do with individuals, sublease income, say a lease back, I think, you know, when you have a lease that's bundled with services, other goods, for that matter, just the line between leasing and services, service contracts. I mean, these are all important issues, whether or not they're central to the fundamental question is the model, you know, need to change. I think all of these things need to be addressed deliberately, and for the pointing out that, at least on the U.S. side, the counting standard we're amending is about 37 years old for lessee. I'll point out it's also 37 years old for lessor, and lots have changed over the time.
With an eye on the clock, Katrina, how many more issues do you have to go through?
Well, I'm going to be handing over to my FESD colleagues, and there are obviously a number of other sections. You know, there's scope, there's measurements, there are, you know, other issues, presentation and presentation.
Okay, so can I ask everybody to drink, otherwise we'll live for many hours. First, I would like to thank the staff for an extraordinarily helpful piece of work here. It really has helped me understand, I think, where we are at least today and where we need to go over the short term. I'm struck by really two or three messages from this letter. One is, as Jan said, a very broad array of views. You know, I don't see an extraordinary consensus forming around the models that we propose.
That can be no surprise.
No. As you said, Hans, consistency is always something we don't do. The other key point, I guess, here with respect to the model is that while we have, I think, a clear majority of users to move forward with recognition of assets and liabilities, there's obviously, I think, a broad array of views as to what that model should be. That, I think, argues, as Wegwo suggested, to make sure we design a model that's going to meet their needs and take our time in that respect. On the lessor side, I was struck by the fact that the majority of constituents had various concerns with the proposed model. They don't support the proposed dual model, although they'd like to make changes to it. And again, that argues for trying to understand what those needs are. So I guess in summary, I really feel as you go down the path of setting the path for redeliberation, I think what's going to be critical is to look at scope, definition, and measurement almost as a package before you make any decisions with respect to them. Because if you make a decision about measurement, you know, before, or the model, before you decide what's going to go into the model, I think you could end up in the same problem we've had in other projects, a revolving door where you have to bring something back. So I think it makes sense to start looking at these things in a package, some of these issues as they're interrelated, and not necessarily rush to judgment as to, you know, what's the model and try to retrofit everything, you know, back into that. So Katrina, we're going to
yeah. Okay, on lessor, any comments, observations? Tom?
When I started this project, I thought it would be very obvious that there should be symmetry between the lessor and lessee. The more I've thought about it, I'm not convinced that's true any longer whatsoever, because I think there's a key difference in the economics on the lessor side than the lessee. The lessor's total return is affected by the residual value of the asset they get back, assuming they're getting a residual value asset back. And that causes me to think about the economics of the total circumstance different for the lessor and lessee, which would suggest to me there's the potential that absolute symmetry between the sides are not necessary for us in our final conclusion. However, I don't also see the possibility of leaving the lessor model alone, given we're changing the definition of the lease, the scope of the project, with subleasing, etc. And if we end up with classifications two different classifications of lease for whatever reason, on the lessor side or the lessee side, some ability to understand why those would be the same or different, I think will be important in addressing the model going forward. But I hope we don't, as we have previously, almost always concentrated on lessee for about 90% of the deliberations and spend maybe even not 10% of the deliberations on lessors. I hope when we go back together that we think about both sides of the model and some of how they relate to each other, but not necessarily assuming symmetry in the accounting is necessary.
Larry? So I'm not sure if this is going to be contrarian or what, but...
Larry, we cannot hear you.
I guess my reading of the comments we received on lessor is such that the vast majority of people don't think the changes that we propose are providing very useful information. I guess at the end of the day, contrary to what Gary said, while we might have a lessor model that is just as old as the lessee model, perhaps the reason why people aren't adjusting the lessor financial statements and the reason why people objected to what we proposed is that the current lessor model seems to be working just fine. So before the staff goes spending a heck of a lot of work in evaluating alternatives to the lessor model that was proposed, et cetera, I'd like us to step back and say, okay, you know, do we have a lessor model that is working? Do we really need to change it to the extent that we do have changes that are reflective of the changing definition of leases, et cetera? Okay, fine. I think we have to address those. But I would hope that we do not spend a lot of time creating a widget that really isn't necessary.
When you say step back, do you think that's additional analysis by the staff, or do you think you have enough information to make that view?
I think it would be nice to have a memo that, you know, puts it all together, et cetera, but I generally think that I have a decent amount of information, but it would be nice to see it in an organized fashion.
Right. Mark and Jim?
I was just going to agree a little bit more with Gary, perhaps, than Larry. I agree with Gary Kaberick that symmetry wasn't between lessee and lessor isn't as critical, and I do think that the feedback has indicated that it's more important to understand and address potentially any inconsistencies with revenue recognition and have symmetry there as opposed to trying to force symmetry with the lessee model.
But somewhere in between where Mark and Larry are at, I think it might be useful to consider whether we can conform to the revenue document. Maybe that can be easily done. Maybe that's a broader change. I'm not exactly sure. But I do have share the sentiment that Larry does of lessor accounting model. I think we heard was not broke. And, in fact, one of the concerns on the lessee side was investors are making adjustments. I think what we heard from many on the lessor side is if you go forward with what you've proposed, we'll make adjustments. There'll be adjustments to get back to the accounting that we have today. And so, kind of a...
Larry? My major concern with trying to tie this thing directly to the RevRec project is, let's just remember how long it took us to wrestle licenses to the floor.
Al? I think I'm pretty much in the same place that Larry is. I do not want to see us spending a tremendous amount of time fixing something that's not broken. And I said my alternative view, you know, as this document went out, lessor is not broken, let's not fix it, let's not spend our resources there, let's not add cost and complexity. If there is a single memo that can address a few of these finer points, I'm more than happy to entertain that. But I would not like to see us spending a lot of time and resource on that aspect of the project.
Okay. Daryl?
Like many, I came to the lessor side thinking that symmetry was sort of a requirement, if you will, and sort of feeling bad if we couldn't get there with symmetry. But I've completely changed that now, and whereas I think Tom referred to it as, you know, symmetry might not be necessary, I would go even further and say I'm not even sure symmetry is desirable because of the things that he pointed out in terms of the difference in the way that lessees and lessors approach leases and view them from a business standpoint. So because of that, you know, I'm not enamored with chasing symmetry anymore, but I do think that there's probably some tweaks that need to be made for consistency reasons.
Anything else? All right. Can I turn over to you, Danielle? Or Lisa?
Thanks, Scott. The next sections we're going to cover, it's going to include definition of a lease, separating components, the short-term lease exception, and scope. So that should be paragraphs 90 through 129. For definition of a lease, again, we aligned that with revenue and consolidation. Some noted in the comment letters that this was going to be the new line. Many requested further guidance, stressing the importance of this definition, and a few also wanted to retain the current definition. For separating components, there was concern about the practical application, both the need and the availability of a standalone observable price. Some wanted the right to estimate a price so they could separate your lease and non-lease components, and others requested almost like a practical expedient where they would be allowed to not separate your lease and non-lease components.
No. Could you speak up a little bit?
Can't you adjust the volume somehow for everyone?
Tried this.
Okay, go ahead.
Sure. For short-term lease exception, many agreed with the idea, but many were also concerned that the relief was not significant enough. Some would like the short-term lease exception to be closer aligned with the lease term. So therefore, instead of having a maximal possible term of 1 year with including your renewals, they would ask that you would only include renewals if there is a significant economic incentive. Others requested that the exception just be extended beyond 1 year, possibly to 3 years or et cetera. And then moving along to scope, many supported the overall scope. The main comment that we did receive under scope, which Petrina kind of brought up before, was directed towards the core and non-core breakout and whether the boards could kind of think through that process again. Again, just stressing that these small ticket items and the volume of these transactions and kind of the low dollar amount that it would impact on the financial statements. So with that, I will turn it over to the boards for discussion.
Okay. Any comments, thoughts here? Mark?
Just to agree that definition is going to be the new line, and not to underestimate this issue. I think substitutability and clarifying, you know, what that means, what it means to direct the use of, is going to be important. And, you know, I know some suggested that we try to define what a service is to show what the difference is between a lease and a service. And I just, having been through RevRec, I'm not sure that's going to be a easy thing to do. I'm not sure how fruitful that will be, but definition is going to be very important.
Okay. All right, Hans, over to you.
Any comments here? Scope issue. When we talk about scope issues, quantitative data could be more eloquent. So paragraph 126 is a very good example of a micro level. But I think we have micro level data as well. Which was done in Japan, and that was surveyed down for all listed companies in the Tokyo Stock Exchange. According to that survey, total remaining balance of operating lease is only 0.9% of the total assets of the listed company, which is less than 1%. And even if we made it on balance, that would only increase the 1% of the total assets. That is the data. And also, the survey also provides more interesting details. That is, only 100 companies out of 1,800 companies comprise over 80% of lease commitments. So they are heavy users of operating leases, but others are not. But on the other hand, for more than 90% of the companies, the balance of remaining operating lease commitment is less than 5% of total assets of each company. And moreover, about 80% companies, the balance of remaining lease commitment is less than 1%.
Okay.
Then my conclusion is this is not specific, special to Japan, but a similar outcome was found in the Europe. I don't know what in the United States. So, but the good thing about the data is we can focus the target. So in the case of Tokyo Stock Exchange, our target is probably 100 companies, not other companies. So probably if we could do a more statistical survey, the macro basis, could help us to target our standard. And that would help to make our scope.
As I hear those numbers, it will be a very easy operation in Japan. Okay, next topic.
Going to turn over to Sydney.
I'm going to talk about measurement, which is paragraph 130 through 175 of the memo. So the staff received a significant amount of feedback on the measurement proposals in the 2013 ED. This covers lease term, variable lease payments, discount rates, and other payments. So most constituents, including most users, prefer the higher threshold for the lease term that's proposed in the 2013 ED as compared to the more likely than not threshold proposed in the 2010 ED. However, a majority of constituents express concern about the interpretation of significant economic incentives, and many suggested that the boards retain the reasonably assured or reasonably certain terminology in existing guidance if they intend is for significant economic incentive to be interpreted consistently or applied consistently to today. Additionally, most constituents expressed concern about the requirement to reassess the lease term when there's a change in relevant factors resulting in the lessee having or no longer having a significant economic incentive to exercise the option. These constituents suggested reassessment only at the occurrence of a significant triggering event or reassessment at a higher than individual lease level. For variable lease payments, most constituents, including most users, support the changes made to the 2010 ED. Many constituents, though, commented on the difficulty of interpreting the meaning of in-substance fixed payments and requested that the boards provide additional guidance on the application of this term. Additionally, almost all constituents expressed concern about the reassessment proposals and suggested three alternatives. No reassessment, but instead recognizing the difference in profit and loss each period. Reassessment only when the lessee begins to make payments on the basis of the changed indexer rate, or reassessment only in the context of a reassessment for another reason, such as the reassessment of a lease term. For discount rate, most constituents did not comment on the board's proposals, but some did note the significant administrative burden that would result from calculating the incremental borrowing rate for individual leases and suggested that the boards permit a portfolio approach in estimating discount rates for lease liabilities with similar terms. The staff received a limited amount of feedback on the proposals for other lease payments, including initial direct costs and residual value guarantees, and the details are discussed in the memo. I'm going to turn it over to the board for discussion.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments? Mark?
I'll just say the outreach was very helpful for me on the discount rate. Until going out and actually talking to the companies and actually in the Brazil roundtable, this was brought up as well. I didn't appreciate just how operationally challenging it might be to try to think about this on a discount rate on a lease-by-lease basis with potentially some of the underlyings collateralized, some of them not, in a non-public into the environment as well. So I thought the outreach was very, very helpful to get my head around some of the operational challenges on discount rate. I think they're solvable, but I thought the outreach did exactly what it was intended to do there, which was highlight any operational challenges.
Yeah. I thought there was a number of areas in these categories where constituents gave us some useful feedback as to where to simplify things like significant economic disincentive. If we don't mean a change, then maybe there's just the easy solution is don't create one. Several areas I thought maybe easy wins in reducing cost and complexity of the proposal.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay, Hans, I'll turn it over to you.
Any comments here? Mary?
One item on the portfolio suggestions that's covered in this section. I don't think the biggest item that we have to face, but I have a strong reaction to it, which is the staff was saying, should we just provide comments that you can use portfolio if not materially different from looking at it on an individual lease basis? And I think the alternative that when we come to look at this issue, I'm not saying prioritize this issue, we should actually be looking at is whether we get more bang for the buck, as it were, from looking at criteria that say, look at this on a portfolio basis. It might go to some of the discount rate issues that Mark was just talking about, and I think in terms of simplifications would offer more than one of the things we seem to be saying. Can we just create a bit of fuzz about when you can do portfolio? And maybe there's some good learnings from other projects that we want to think about in that context.
Okay.
My suggestion, just to add to the Mary's point, is that if you can import what used to be paragraph 6 of the revenue recognition, I think it's new paragraph 4, I think that will take care of this issue to a large extent, because I think it was well appreciated, and just add on to that, maybe that will take care of this, some of the issues there.
PK, many of us don't have that document memorized. Do you want to give us a little hint as to what this paragraph says?
It is about the portfolio, when you can use a portfolio exception, because the revenue is by contract, and when you can use a portfolio approach to alleviate the concerns, and that's the paragraph. Here, offline, I can dictate to you, and you can understand better a bit.
Okay. That's it for here. From here?
Lisa? Okay. Back to Lisa.
Okay. Next, we're going to go talk about transition, implementation concerns, effective date, cost benefit, and behavioral changes. This is going to cover paragraphs 208 to 243. The biggest concern under these paragraphs is really about the cost of implementing the proposals. Patrina discussed this a little bit before, but some of those costs or concerns include system updates, collecting the necessary data, educating personnel, designing and implementing new controls, educating investors, regulatory concerns, debt covenants, tax bankruptcy implications. And really, there's a lot of requests for a significant lead time between when we get a final standard issued and when that effective date would be. From the non-public entities, there's also the request for the one-year extension. And I think just from an overall cost-benefit discussion, the staff plans to be discussing cost-benefits on the individual redeliberation issues, and then again, it would be brought together once the full package is proposed. So with that, I'll turn over to the board, and we can cover any further specifics on those.
Hans, you want to start this time?
Sure. This is probably going to be the key issue. At least one of the key issues of the deliberation. No comments at this time.
Well, I can give one, and it's almost what I said before. That's the information I got when I was out seeing a number of preparers was very vague views on this, and I think if we can come up with like Mary and PK are indicating, how we can manage
a lot of small things, I think that we are most likely helping these people a lot. And allowing time is important. We had a discussion with one major corporate who had a tremendous lot of leases, all sorts, lessor, lessee, big and small things. And then made a rather thorough analysis, and they said, if we do this in 2 to 3 years, it will be extremely expensive. It will give us 1 year extra. We can fit it into our normal IT development program. So exactly how we do this timing, I think, will have a major impact on the cost for transforming into the new standard.
Okay, over to you, Russ.
Okay, any comments on this section? Okay.
Steve. All right, thank you. Feedback was received on a variety of other issues related to the 2013 ED, including for both the FASB and IASB, presentation, disclosures, subleases, sale leasebacks, unit of account, business combinations, and interactions with other projects. For the FASB only, non-public entities, related party leases, leveraged leases, and other consequential amendments. And for the IASB only, consequential amendments related to IAS 40. For the purposes of this meeting, staff would like to highlight several items related to presentation, disclosures, and non-public entities. To begin, constituent feedback was generally mixed and relatively limited with regards to the proposed presentation requirements. Those comments that were received primarily reflected the constituent support or opposition to the underlying accounting model driving the related presentation. However, several additional areas warranting board consideration were identified, including clarification with regards to the tangible or intangible nature of right-of-use assets, and the presentation of short-term lease payments, variable lease payments, and non-lease components. Moving on, constituent feedback related to disclosures was significantly divided between users and preparers. Users contended that no single amount can provide a complete picture of an entity's leasing activities, and so a comprehensive disclosure package such as those proposed is important for their analysis and provides valuable information. Alternatively, preparers were opposed to the disclosure proposals, stating that requirements are excessive and complex and would require substantial investments in more robust IT systems. Some think that it is counterintuitive that entities would be required to provide additional disclosures compared to existing requirements when those entities would also be required to recognize lease assets and liabilities. And finally, overall comments from non-public entities were not significantly different from those offered by public entities. Distinctive feedback did include support for the exemption from the lease liability roll-forward disclosures, support for a practical expedient in determining the discount rate used in calculating the lease liability, but concerns about the appropriateness of the use of a risk-free discount rate to achieve this because it would increase liabilities on the balance sheet. Constituents suggested use of an estimated incremental borrowing rate or the rate on an entity's most recent line of credit as alternative methods to achieve this. And lastly, concerns about cost and transition. With that, I turn it over to the board for any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Hans?
Questions, Mayor?
No questions.
Just one question.
Not really a question, more a remark. I think it's a bit difficult to discuss cost and transition before we discuss the possible simplification to the model, because clearly the costs are a direct result of how complex or simple a model is. And the time needed for transition and investment in IT systems also depends quite a lot about how sophisticated the model is. So I think I would put those discussions only after we have discussed really what the model requires.
Okay, over to you, Russ.
Okay, I think that's it for that memo. There's no other questions on a comprehensive summary of the feedback. We will turn.
Mark.
Oh, I'm sure.
Sorry, I probably should have said this before. No. I just want to touch on the cost benefit one more time. I mean, we obviously got ton of feedback there, a ton of suggestions and input, et cetera. The what we're trying to do, and if Jan is right, you know, investors are trying to use this information to make decisions about how to invest capital, et cetera. And if Jan is right, then the investors are potentially getting it wrong today with their very rough calculations of what they're able to do. So if we are to make changes, then the benefits would be people would be able to better understand and make allocation decisions about allocating capital, right? So that's the benefits of what we're trying to do. The costs of that are the cost to prepare and audit and make those adjustments to recognition, measurement, disclosure, et cetera, right? There will be consequences when people get better information. That's expected, right? That's the objective of what we're trying to do. We're not trying to do an analysis of economic consequences, overall macroeconomic consequences as a result of the new standard. We're trying to assess the costs of implementing new recognition, measurement, presentation, disclosure areas. I think that, you know, when we talk about cost or benefit, we often talk past each other, and I just wanted to make sure we were all sort of on the same page about what costs and benefits are and what they're not.
Okay, thank you. Danielle?
Okay, thank you. We will switch now to paper 3B, that's the memo 260, which talks about our redeliberations plan. And I think, you know, we've gone through a lot of different topics and feedback on all the different issues of the proposal, but really the staff think that there are five main issues that we need to consider in redeliberations, and that is in paragraph 3 of this memo, the lessee accounting model, the lessor accounting model, lease classification, definition and scope, as well as measurement. So I don't want to reiterate what everyone has already heard on these topics, but just to point out that we need to come back to the boards on the lessee accounting model and think about ways forward, which will include consideration of cost and complexity, including decision usefulness. And we will also, when we're considering the lessee model, we'll also want to consider the lessor model. We've had some discussions here about whether there should be symmetry or should not, and whether those decisions on the two models impact each other. And we also wanted to bring back some scope simplifications. I think there's been a lot of support for trying to scope out small ticket items and to see if that helps out in alleviating some cost and complexity of the models, and if that will also help board members to think about their decision on the lessee and lessor accounting models. And as I said, we will have to talk about, you know, what change is needed to lessor accounting. I think we've gotten some feedback to, instead of focusing on trying to fix the receivable and residual approach, to maybe take a step back and consider if there is drastic changes needed to today's current lessor accounting model. And for lease classification, obviously that would be integral to any dual lessee or lessor accounting model. So we'll have to think about, are we going to retain a mix of type A, type B, and if so, where we draw that line, whether we stick with what we proposed in the exposure draft or come up with a better way to have the lease classification to simplify the accounting that we will end up with. And then we've talked a little bit about the definition and the scope, and we've talked about how we need to make sure we have a good definition of a lease. The distinction between leases and services will be a new focus. And then we've talked about separating lease and non-lease components as well. And then I think we've already hit on the point of trying to align the short-term exception with the definition of lease term so that that might provide additional relief or deciding how we're going to address the small ticket items that might be something, an extension of the short-term exception. And then for measurement, Sydney did a good job going through the different areas of measurement, and I think, as Jim mentioned, we can make a lot of decisions that would simplify and take some of the complexity out of the measurement of the lease liability if we consider some of the suggestions that were offered by our constituents. And then in paragraph 21 of the memo, we just have a list of, you know, then all the other following issues. Once we have the model, once we have the definition, once we are more clear on the measurement, we can then address the presentation, disclosure, transition, et cetera, and some of the more specific areas. So on paragraph 23 of this memo, we haven't put together a timeline, but we kind of have at least put out what we thought would be the natural progression of which issues to tackle first as we go through the redeliberations. And so we thought it would be best to start with the lessee model, the lessor model, the lease classification if there is a dual approach, and the scope simplifications, and then move through the rest of the areas as indicated in this paragraph here. I know Pat Finnegan had some alternative suggestions, so maybe we should talk about that amongst all the board members, and so the staff has direction on how to move forward on these issues.
Okay. Let me start here. Any questions on the strategy and timeline on paragraph 23? Jim?
I suspect there's multiple ways you could attack this, the strategy where you want to start. I thought this was a reasonable way forward, get some of the, you know, the fundamental issues on the table, which, you know, then might have follow-on impact, you know, would impact the later issues as opposed to dealing with those first and then finding out, well, the fundamental kind of questions either made the point moot. So I thought it was a reasonable approach. I did wonder if we could at some point a little bit greater clarity on the timeline, because as Daniel, you say, it's sequenced but not timed.
Yeah.
There seemed to be some significant support for doing something with lessor different than in the ED. Is that something that should be brought earlier in the process to take that off, if that's the direction we went in, to take that off the table, or is it better to do that later in the process?
I think we thought it would be best to do that first, take the lessor model first.
Lessor first over lessee?
Over lessee, and then see if that decision...
I would agree with that. So I would just, but the way the paragraph was written, it's lessee than lessor.
Why is that better?
I think, personally, I just think that the quicker you can clear away some significant issues, you start to get, you increase the ability to focus on the things where we really do have differences, and I think that could speed up the process.
If I could just ask you on that specific point, I mean, I guess for me, and notwithstanding what people said earlier, I would still see symmetry in the model really important. And it seems to me that the bigger issues are in the lessee. I would agree with that, but I find it very difficult to make a lessor decision without having some idea of where the lessee, what the direction of the lessee model is going to be, because I would put symmetry as sort of one of the more important things in the model. I realize that some people expressed a view earlier that they didn't see symmetry as important, and maybe that was the discussion that you were thinking we would have early on. But I would find it very difficult to put aside lessor without knowing what the lessee view is or what the lessee direction is.
Yeah. And Daryl, just to respond to that, I think that several people, at least here, thought that we did not need symmetry. And if that were the case, then I would not want to spend a lot of time on the lessee trying to debate that issue if we ultimately concluded that symmetry was not a noble goal and objective in this case.
But aren't you really saying
that? Maybe the early discussion then would be about symmetry rather than about the model.
That's directionally where I was heading with that, correct.
Tom?
I thought I heard you say, Danielle, was that we start off with a sort of an integrated approach to considering the big issues in lessor and lessee accounting, and then drill down after that point in time, not just exclusively lessor accounting, but sort of how they relate to each other. And I think that would be a very good step to do. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so if we make a decision on lessor, and we also consider that in, as we're looking at the lessee and see if that impacts our decision on lessee, so that we're kind of making those decisions at the same time, at the same meeting.
But does that mean focus on symmetry first if that's something we still want to pursue? Because that changes the direction of several of the discussions later on. If we say symmetry is important, then you do them concurrent. If you say symmetry is not important, then I would argue deal with the lessor, get that out of the way, and then deal with the rest of the issues.
Well, I think the idea when you say deal with the lessor, we need to decide, are we going to refine the proposal in the ED, or are we going to do something more, you know, keep current lessor accounting unchanged? And then does that impact whether we have symmetry with lessee or not?
Yeah, I guess I was flipping it in.
Scott wants to get in. Well, I was just going to say, I think it's important that we don't think necessarily that the board should have to decide at the same time, but we do believe that it's going to influence their decision
to understand where we're headed in both directions. So as the staff have been thinking forward to the next part, as we drafted this plan, as we think forward, we've been thinking about these holistically, all the questions about the models, because we think it's impossible to, you know, extricate all of them from each other, even if at the end of the day you're able to make a decision on one without necessarily coming to a consensus on the other at the same point in time.
Yeah, but I think what Hal was asking, I agree with this, is that if we first were to conclude, do we want to think of this as a package, then I think you're right, Scott. If we sit there and say, we don't think of lessor and lessee as a package, and let's look at improvements for lessor, let's look at improvements for lessee, I think that changes the content of the analysis, it changes the thought process later on. And so to me, it seems like the first question is, do we want to think of lessor and lessee as a package deal or not? And then if the answer is no, what do you want to do in lessor? What do you want to focus on lessee? And then you go down. If the package is yes, then I think you have to kind of talk about how to align this and think about both at the same time. That's I think, Hal's point and Tom's point.
Yeah, I think that there are aspects that will prevent us from severing the two completely. Definition of a lease, scope, subleasing issues. And I think if we end up having a classification line at all, we'll be challenged to ask if it's different from one than the other, why it is.
True, but it narrows down the number of issues, and I think that would speed up and make the process far more efficient.
And that's what I'm arguing, too. High-level integrative consideration of the approach generally, considering both sides, but not saying it has to be symmetric, make the decision.
Correct.
Katrina?
I suppose I just wanted, by the way, maybe not helpful, to just rephrase the question slightly if helpful, and maybe it's feeding off kind of what Ross said, which is when we put this plan together, we I suppose, put it together thinking of, you know, a package that you would want to think about lessee, lessor, and possible scope simplifications together. And I suppose the background to that would be, and this is the question for you, is that do you think there's possible interdependencies between, you know, each way? So, for example, you don't think you could possibly decide on the way forward on lessee without thinking about lessor at the same time, or vice versa, you can't think about the way forward on lessor without lessee. I suppose the question maybe I was just going to rephrase to you and giving us your advice is, do you think there are interdependencies both ways? So do you think that you could and therefore would prefer to make decisions on lessee first and only do lessor later, or vice versa, do you think you can make a decision on lessor without knowing what you do in lessee? And I suppose if we conclude there are interdependencies both ways, then it kind of says more as a package. If you think you can make one set of decisions independent of the other, then there might be a reason to split.
That was the point of my first question. I mean, to Tom's point about scope and some other things, I think those ought to be the same. But I think the first question is really the question you asked, Katrina, and it's really something I think we should do right away, and I think that will then drive the rest of the scope of the project. Now, I think you wrote your plan presuming we would all answer that question that Katrina asked as yes. But I think what we've learned around here is I'm not yet convinced that we would all answer that question yes right now. Jim, do you want to get
it? And I think that's why, Russell, sorry, that's why I wanted to rephrase the question, because maybe if you think about it in the context of, do you think you could make your decisions on lessee, you know, without knowing where you want, you know, having a final answer on lessor, or do you think you could alternatively make your answer on lessor before deciding where you are
in this?
Very interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
It's a package.
I would have viewed it opposite. I would have said, let's start with, are we planning to make fundamental changes to the lessor model? And if the sense was no, that might entail an entirely different level or maybe lower level of effort going forward. Appreciating that they're at the end, maybe, or during, or throughout, some question about whether you want to conform the scope. But it seems to me, if you call the question, do you fundamentally want to change lessor accounting, that would, you know, vastly impact the plan.
Any other points on our side on the redeliberation plan? I think you've got all the topics in here. I think it's just a matter of order. Okay, Hans?
Young?
But in what order we take things, I think we should be a little bit careful of sort of giving, let's call it affirmative and clear directions on lessors without knowing where we end this up, because we will never be able to back this off. And like my Chinese friend on the left here said before, what will happen is, of course, that when you leave one battlefield, that enemy will go to the other enemy and work against us. And I'm personally not... I was a bit surprised that we really took lessors on, but now we have done that and we made an exposure draft. And I would really prefer that we start, because I don't see this as a major problem. As Daryl pointed out, the major problem is the lessee. So I think we should start by clearing out the lessees, and from there on, maybe that we have consequences for the lessors. And if we have started off by saying, okay, we do like this with the lessors, we have lost that forever.
No, I agree with you. The lessor accounting is a secondary issue to the lessee accounting. We should not expect a solution for lessor accounting to clear the way for the other bigger problem. So it's better to confront the bigger problem head on, I think, and then the other minor or secondary issues will follow from that. Patricia?
Like Jan, I started this project lessee only, but there was so much pressure to add lessor and so much support for a symmetrical answer that I don't think that, based on my understanding of the feedback right now, all I know is people have decided that they don't think symmetry is important anymore, but I don't have a good grasp of why. So I don't think I could, at this moment, make an informed decision about why I would drop lessor accounting. And I think I don't know whether I need to know where the lessee is coming out to make that decision, but I know I need to know more than I know right now about why people have changed their mind about symmetry.
I have four people. We go. Please.
You know, let's start with the symmetrical or not, with whether we drop lessor or not. One thing we have to keep in mind, I already talked about the two enemies or enemies, is if we let the few, you know, drop of lessor, we still have the lessor accounting at all in the standard. We still have to justify why lessor should have two models, your operating and the non-operating. We still have to decide the draw a line, whether we keep the curve line, and let's assume we keep curve line based on this reward. And we contradict with our decision on the thing. You know, so this one, but I have one major suggestion related to cost and complexity. I feel we should do, and we can do something about small tickets, but slightly different from Tucker's proposal. My main focus is on the service, related service. You know, if service is...
Let's not get into solutions right now. We're just identifying issues.
My suggestion may be helpful, you know. I always feel, if it's low value, you know, no problem. If sometimes you use your account, you know, you can go, no problem. But key problem is related to physical service. And if there is a case, maybe we can expand the service part and they pick out many of the transactions. And secondly, we can use practical ability to let people not use it. And that would scope out a lot of transactions. I will go this direction and reduce complexity.
Yes, number of thoughts. First thing, I would start off the deliberations with scope. from the third bucket there. If you think of every standard we write, every standard the FASB writes, what are the first sections? It's scope and definition. So there's a reason for that. Because you want to know what you're talking about, what are you trying to recognize, what are you trying to measure. So I would say definition of a lease, separating the lease, unit of account, lease versus service contracts, the other simplifications. I think we need, and Pat was on that, you know, beginning of the meeting. I think that's critical to start there. And once you know what you want to measure and what you want to place, as opposed to deciding the model first and then try to force fit transactions or principles into it, I think you decide what is it you want to measure and recognize in the model. You resolve that first. Then you go on to other stuff. I'm not, I think the model is actually in the middle of this, perhaps. You know, once you define scope and stuff like this. I think at that point, I agree the lessee model is the more important issue than the lessor model. But I think there was enough feedback that said there's still work needed done on the lessor model. Even if it's not fundamentally broke, I think enough people wanted work done. And so I don't think it can get dropped too quickly. As I had said earlier and others did, it's important to for lessor to be aligned with the revenue recognition. I think that's a must-have. I think it's a nice-have to have to be aligned with lessee. Within measured in weeks, we're going to be having a revenue recognition standard hitting the streets. All the major firms are going to write their books on it, and they're going to start looking into knock-on effects, whether it be an insurance project, whether it be a leasing project or other things. And preparers are going to start really dissecting the revenue recognition model and the limitations, the gaps, you know, the things that didn't get caught up will get picked up as people start trying to work with it. And again, if you want to have lessor accounting aligned with revenue recognition, I don't think most people agree with that. I think we've got to give the revenue recognition standard a bit of time on this street. It's still early, but I think that's absolutely critical. I think I look back, I think, you know, been involved in leasing most of my career. We've got to keep this cost effective and I call it err on the side of simplicity. And I'm dating myself, so the source of these numbers I'm going to use is from a book that's said by Arthur Anderson. But after FAS 13 was written, because the subject is so complex, and it's no less complex now, there's seven major follow-on FASB standards, the minimum of 55 EITFs and finance. Interpretation came because it's complex. I think no one wants to repeat that or another derivatives implementation and type scenarios. I think that, as much as we want to get it done, I think that errs on the side of when in doubt, go a little bit slower as opposed to a little bit faster. And then lastly, I don't know if it comes in transition, there's a lot of other, you know, knockdown effects. What do you do about deferred taxes, you know, foreign currency, and when you've got a lease in a hyperinflationary country and so on. So I think this is going to probably, much as we'd like to be on quickly, I suspect this is going to be a little bit longer than people are thinking. But again, so we don't have to keep redoing that board, I think going slow is the right answer.
Mary?
Looking at the strategy and how we approach it, I have very significant concerns about trying to first make a call that says, are we not going to change lessor accounting? But I do believe that we should start looking at lessee accounting. That was our first priority. The main driver for the project was the concern about lessee debt not being on balance sheet. And going back to that priority, I think we should start with lessee. And I think that's probably model, but I'm not so much worried about model versus scope. I think we should hold off making a decision about lessor until we've got a better sense of what we're trying to do with lessee. But I think we also need to remember that we're not starting from scratch. We have an exposure draft that we worked really hard on. We've had a lot of feedback about it. And I think really the first question that we should have in each bite that we take is, what feedback makes us think that the ED, perhaps with some simplifications, is not operational and is not the way forward. And that's not reluctance to change, but I think we should be starting by asking that question, what's the particular feedback that we have? And maybe before we even get to focusing, you know, how we're running the world on, start with a focus on lessee, maybe we should be asking the question, and I think particularly the user feedback, what have we heard from users overall as a group about lessee? Should this, you know, do they believe the debt should be on balance sheet? Do they overall think we should be refining our ID? Or is there a consensus, you know, from that population around another approach? And my sense going through the feedback paper that we did first is that it's maybe a slight majority is focused on prefer refining ours to a single model, but I'm not sure that's an accurate read because, again, we have lots of qualitative words like many and many others and, you know, majority of the many, et cetera. Not a criticism. It was a great paper, and I think we would have stumbled if we'd had lots of statistics at this stage, but it makes it hard to make that assessment. But going back to something that Jim and Russ said in the first section, I agree absolutely with Russ that having had all this information, we don't need to start going out and getting more information and more feedback before we start work.
We should use what we have.
Let's use what we have and see if it, as we're working through things, it identifies shortfalls. But I also agree with Jan that we have to be critical and, you know, skeptical maybe in terms of assessing some of the feedback, especially about cost and complexity, before we start reacting to it. So rather than saying, here's the feedback, we must respond to this, say, here's the feedback, what is being cited, before we think about how do we respond to that. And again, I guess that just brings me back to what I said as the first question that I think we should be asking, which is, you know, what feedback makes us think that RED with simplification is not operational? So I think we should start with lessee. I think we should be starting from the ED, but I think I could benefit from one kind of overview, particularly from the user perspective, about the problems that particularly motivated us to take this on, which is the lessee accounting. And from that, move forward.
I completely agree with Mary. We should better analyze what we have rather than vote again to try to get new information, but have a good solid analysis of what we have. When Gary said to ourselves, go slow, I sighed, because of course we must do this very carefully, and people are watching us very closely here and with a lot of skepticism. So yes, we have to be very careful and measured and convinced of what we are doing. But the minute that we say to ourselves, go slow, it will be very, very slow. The wealth of information that we have now should not be an excuse to procrastinate and try to go into the details of every comment letter. We have to remain decisive if we want to bring this to a fruitful end. That's it for here? Okay.
Tom? I don't know. If I were the staff, I don't know how I'd react to everything they just said. Because some say do lessor first, some say do lessee first, some say do scope first, whatever. All I want to say is, after 8 years of doing this, I trust the staff, after having read all the comment letters and having to write papers for us, that they know the best way to bring things forward. And so generally, I accept whatever approach they think is the right thing for us to do.
I think that's it. We don't have anything else. So we're adjourned here.
Okay, thank you.